Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we're talking about that movie with the twist, Fight Club. It's Chris's favorite movie ever, so this is a special episode. We discuss the depth of the movie's commentary and how the meta-narrative helps the message thrive in a timeless way.
Fight Club, Travis. We finally get to talk about Fight Club.
You've already broken the first rule of Fight Club.
Oh no.
Could you get out of here? Go.
Could you imagine if we did the whole episode without ever... Oh, that would have been such a good idea. We just did an episode about Fight Club where we never mentioned Fight Club. We didn't talk about it the whole time.
We never say the words Fight Club.
Yeah, it's just that movie.
Yeah, we just talk about that Winnie the Pooh movie instead where he's a raving lunatic murderer.
Yeah, what, Blood Honey? Yeah. Is that the subtitle? And then we could also, you know, just discuss Never Been Kissed. For sure. Those of you who have the physical version of Fight Club and know that inside joke.
I don't know that. I feel like I have a hazy memory of whatever this is, but I don't know what it is.
It's just on the DVD back in the day, like the original DVD, and it's still on the Blu-ray that I have. When the movie first loads, it loads up the DVD title screen of Never Been Kissed, and has Drew Barrymore there, all the options to play the movie in the scenes. It's all like bright and bubbly, and you're just staring at it. Like, did I get the wrong disc? What happened? And then it kind of jumps and then jumps again and then transitions into the Fight Club title screen.
Mm. Drew Barrymore. I just watched Scream. And it's so crazy of me to think of her in that movie. Like, she was big then.
Yeah.
And for her to just do the open, like, it's such an iconic opening scene too. Like, she knew it was going to be iconic. It's crazy. And I'm only mentioning Scream, honestly, because it's on the brain. A, I just watched it, but B, I did think about it a lot during this movie because Fight Club is also kind of a meta. Well, not kind of a meta movie. It's a very meta movie.
It's a very meta. Like, they... They, oh my God, 1 second.
Okay.
There's a UPS truck outside.
Ah, the dreaded UPS truck.
Oh, he's walking off the truck.
Coming up to the house.
Just turn the corner, coming up to the house.
I just, UPS was just at my house dropping off some movies I ordered.
Nice.
We really want to kill some time with some movie talk. I got a 4-pack of Francois Truffaut movies. Some Truffaut movies I've always wanted to watch that like were never really available. And like I was always like, where do I find these? And then they were just suddenly available. And I was like, I'll buy them. I got Staying Alive on 4K. The Sylvester Stallone directed John Travolta starring sequel to Saturday Night Fever. And Killer's Kiss, the Stanley Kubrick movie in 4K. Booyah.
How many Kubrick movies are in 4K?
Several, actually. It's kind of weird. There are so many directors who have none, and then for Kubrick, they're like, put them all on there.
For example, Fight Club, not on 4K.
Is Fight Club... I feel like some foreign copy must be on 4K, but yeah, that's weird that in the States they haven't done that.
Yeah.
A lot of 90s movies. Like, I was like, how does Boogie Nights not on 4K? You know, like, stuff like that. Like, all these big movies. So many Coen brother movies. I don't know. It's strange.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah. Anyway, meta.
Okay. So, meta. Yeah, Fight Club is very meta. I think it's the first meta movie I kind of ever watched back in the day.
Man. It was huge for me on this watch. I guess we'll get into it now, right? Because the lore of Chris watching Fight Club it's going to take up the first 30 minutes of this show.
I know. Yeah, if there's anything you want to get into right now.
I'll say that I first watched Fight Club, I mean, back when I first got in the movies, like 06, IMDb, like Fight Club is, you know, probably in the top 20 back then. I don't know if it still is, of the top 250. Like, it was such a huge movie. It was almost like it was such a joke. Like, it was such a cliche. There were guys on the floor of my freshman dormitory that had posters of it. Like, dudes loved Fight Club, and I was like, all right, I guess I gotta watch this Fight Club movie. And back then I had the reaction of like, it's okay, but it's super overrated. And I think part of me like wanted to rebel against the typical dude that likes Fight Club. Like, I didn't want to be that guy. I don't know if that was really part of me, but looking back at myself, I feel like that probably was part of it. And I didn't watch it again until I met Mr. Christopher J. H. Lambert. And I found out it was his favorite movie. And I assume every time I've watched it since has been the result of you. Like, I don't know if I ever would have watched it again. But I think I've seen it 3 times now since knowing you. Where the first time I watched it, I was like, it's better than I remember. The second time I watched it, I think I watched it like 3-4 years ago. I was like, okay, it's better. I'm seeing, you know, the machinations of this movie. I get why it transcends above like a normal movie. And this last watch for this podcast, I kind of saw the light. It just in the way it's crafted, yeah. The way it moves.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, I won't go as far to give it this descriptor yet. Maybe the next time I watch it, it'll finally cement. But it's in the territory of what I would refer to as a perfect movie, where to me, like Jaws is like this, or Total Recall or something like that, where it's very clear what it's about, and every step of the way is pushing it towards, like, it's further and further realizing what it's supposed to be about and how it's supposed to be a reflection of your life. And like every element of it, like every tick, every movement is in service of it.
Yes.
And by the end, it comes to fruition. Like, it's so satisfied and so realized and so cathartic. Fight Club is very much like that. So this view, and I finally got that, where I was in step with it the whole time. Like, I'd seen it enough. I knew what it was doing enough to where I was just in step with it. So it was a great watch, and I'm very excited to talk about it.
It makes me so happy to hear that, because that was also jumping out to me. Had you watched other Fincher movies before this, or was this your first Fincher back in the day?
Back in the day. I would assume it was my first. I really didn't even, I mean, David Fincher, you know, he's well respected now, and his early movies were, you know, Seven and The Game, and we look at those movies now and we're like, oh, classics. But I think even back then, I had no concept of that legacy that he was starting to build. And by the time, like, I knew him, Zodiac and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button were coming out, and those were movies I didn't really like back then. Mm. So I probably didn't think much of him back then.
Okay. I watched The Game, but it was part of some TBS special, mm-hmm. and I actually thought it was a TBS movie for years, like maybe a decade of my life. I thought The Game was a TBS movie specifically, and only to find out they did some big events for airing it on cable rather than really? It actually being a movie made by TBS.
Wow.
But I caught Fight Club in 2000. It's also number 12 on IMDb right now.
Oh, wow. Still that high.
Yeah. Yeah. So it premiered. I remember the trailers leading up to the movie, and I think those kind of becoming a little bit of a joke, and mm-hmm. just thinking that it was going to be another fighting movie. There had been, you know, action movies over the years and some silly action movies over the years that I just kind of chalked it up to that and never really thought that I would watch it and just kind of forgot about it. So then in 2000, I had just turned, I guess, like 13 and was having a lot of sleeping issues. So I was going to bed a lot of nights at 4 a.m, 5 a.m, and would often just keep the TV on and had HBO on and would just catch movies. It was something that my dad and I did a lot when I was like in middle school. We just watch movies from like 10 o'clock to 2 a.m. in the summer.
Yeah.
And I do, that's how I saw Seven, which I saw the last like 10 minutes of Seven when I was like 11 years old.
Didn't you and I talk about this before? Didn't we both like watch The Wall with our dad in the middle of the night?
Yeah, much so.
So
yes.
Such a bad move on dad's part, by the way. That's not something a child should be exposed to, especially in Twilight.
Yeah, no, late night, The Wall by Pink Floyd.
When you're like a little like punch drunk and like things are kind of hazy and you don't quite understand the world, like that's not a good movie to choose.
Yeah, punch drunk from it being late at night, not children who were
drunk. No. Although I was sipping on some vodka that night.
What? Oh, you're getting your introduction to like hanging out with your dad.
Yeah. He wanted it to be a bro night, so he gave me a little on the side.
But I just remember being like, what is this movie with this box and having no idea. Then that's another episode.
Yeah.
But, so I was catching a lot of movies just randomly that were appearing on HBO. And one night when I turned it on, I saw the last 10 minutes of this movie, starting with the van and them arguing at the van and Brad Pitt being like, you're firing a gun at your imaginary friend in front of 400 gallons of nitroglycerin, and the fight that ensued, and just being like, what am I watching?
You saw the end first.
I saw the end first, and it just, I was obsessed with trying to figure it out, but it's HBO in 2000. So yeah. I was completely dependent on whenever it was playing next to watch the rest of it. So it was something where like over the next 2 weeks, I caught increasing amounts of the movie. So the next time I put it on, it was him traveling around at the end to all the different fight clubs and like the hotel room. That's where I picked it up.
Yeah, right.
And then I caught it another time in like the middle of the movie. And then finally, I picked it up in the first like 20 minutes. So it was like the fifth or sixth time I watched the movie that I actually saw it from the beginning to the end. And I saw it that many times, and having like a degree of insomnia, I was just very fascinated by a movie that was kind of speaking to somebody or speaking to insomnia and that experience.
Mm-hmm.
It was also the first movie that I'd ever watched. I mean, I had been watching movies obsessively as a kid, but you know, the typical ones that kids kind of watch.
Mm-hmm.
Or my parents didn't really have age restrictions, so I'd watch like Predator a lot, Terminator 2, Bloodsport.
Right.
A lot of these popular movies that were kind of literary in a sense. Like I'd watch Total Recall, RoboCop, but this was the first movie that had this degree of literary quality to it and auteur craftsmanship in a way that just completely blew my mind. I had never seen anything like it. And this was playing at the same time as American Beauty. So I had a similar experience with catching parts of this and catching parts of American Beauty and mm-hmm. just being like, movies like this exist.
Yeah, right.
There are movies like this in the world. What, like,
I mean,
I can watch more of these.
Late 90s was, 1999 is one of the best years ever for movies. And you're just seeing all of these directors like Lynch, Coen Brothers, Paul Thomas Anderson, like they're all making movies like this.
Yeah, just in like a whole new zone.
Very artistic.
Yeah. and very different from what we have been getting, you know, from Spielberg, right?
Right. Which, like, you even mentioned Total Recall, which is Paul Verhoeven, who I consider, very much consider an auteur, but, like, his movies are still very Hollywood in that area,
yeah.
You know? Like, they feel kind of familiar in that way. Same with Spielberg, who kind of defined that whole aesthetic. All these people we're mentioning almost felt like they were purposely going another direction.
Yeah, I almost feel like Verhoeven, in some ways, probably a description I'll laugh at later, but like grunge Spielberg.
Sure, yeah. Like it's, or like cheeky Spielberg, like satiric yeah. Spielberg.
Yeah, punk Spielberg.
Like, yeah,
as just right. a lot of the same maneuvers, but with an eye to like the wink, wink, nudge, yeah. nudge of it all.
Yeah.
So I was very blown away and pretty obsessed with Fight Club from the beginning and felt very alone because at 13, how many of the other kids that I knew are yeah. going to be watching Fight Club
right.
or allowed to watch Fight Club? And I remember even then checking some of the reviews from when the movie came out in theaters and people just dumping on it,
really?
Hating it. It was really like... hated when it came out because a lot of the expectation from the marketing was that this was going to be an action movie, like a dumb bro fighting movie.
Right.
And a number of the early reviews, it's not like everybody missed the point of the movie. You have to be kind of a dunce to not think that there's a little bit more going on.
Yeah.
But a lot of the reviews were written by dunces who just kind of chastised it as this hollow, like bro heavy action movie, or like failed attempt at an action movie, and people just didn't like it.
Right.
I mean, the box office was $100 million, which was pretty good.
That's pretty good in 1999.
Yeah, but it was still like really kind of had a in a weird spot, and it was over the next few years that people really started embracing it and being like, oh, you know, that Fight Club movie was actually really good. It had almost like a the Fight Club effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of people kind of latching onto it in the underground. And by the time, you know, we're in college, suddenly there's this whole swath of people that have made Fight Club an yeah. identity for
7 them. Years later.
Yeah, and it becomes this thing that everybody's just like, oh my goodness, like Fight Club, actually a masterpiece. So that was very fulfilling at that time to kind of be ahead yeah. of the curve in everybody hating Fight Club or not interested in it. And then finally coming around to like it being awesome. But then you have to deal with the fact that this movie you love becomes
yeah.
so mainstream that it starts to, you get people that miss the point of it. You get
totally.
People that like it, but you almost want to gatekeep because you're like, do you like it for the right reasons?
It's
do you
weird.
Like it for the right reasons?
That's all I could think this whole time. And not to archetype people, like bros and fraternities all across the country can love this movie for whatever reason they want. But I did kind of think that the whole time, like when Tyler Durden's saying things like, we have no great war. We have no great depression. Like ours is a spiritual war and all of this stuff about like the stuff you own owns you. These really broad, sometimes like honestly banal looks at life, like these like just things you can say about life and like try to generalize a way you live your life and put you in like a certain descriptor. I feel like I can see people like hearing these lines and thinking like, yeah, like we do live our lives like that. Like we shouldn't do that. And to me, the beauty of Fight Club is it's not about learning to live your life like that. It's about finding balance in your life. Because the narrator, the character in this movie, he's torn between these two radical extremes, like who he is at the beginning, buying all the IKEA furniture, kind of like a sheep. And then this rebel, this somebody who completely rebels against the idea of like the way you're supposed to be and goes in the opposite direction. The movie's all about like, no, like you don't need either of these mindsets that are trying to be sold to you. Like you need to like find something from within. You need to discover who you are, blah, blah, blah. And it just, it does make me think, like, a lot of the people who missed the point of the movie think, like, you're supposed to live your life like Tyler Durden, you know?
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Yeah, they take the seduction of the Tyler Durden mindset as what the movie's about. And the movie's actually about, as you're saying, the duality that the IKEA stuff, the consumer sheep version, is definitely wrong. But Tyler is also very wrong. It's not a way to live your life. And you see what's happening to the people in Project Mayhem.
Yes.
Like, they are destroying their lives.
They're no different from the narrator being overtaken by Tyler Durden. Like, they're all falling under his spell as well.
Yeah. And that's essentially, like, people who were fanboying over the movie saw themselves all as Brad Pitt when they're actually like,
all
space
the followers.
Monkeys. Yeah.
Like, that's the genius of it is the narrator, once he finds out he's seeing Tyler Durden in his visions, he's labeled as a psychotic. But everybody else who's following Tyler Durden, like, is also psychotic because they're following someone who isn't real. They're just following the narrator's concept of how to change who he is and the kind of life he should be living. It's not really like, it's not a wizened understanding of the world. He just feels pushed by society to become this completely different person, and all of these people fall under that spell.
Yeah, and the way in which they as much as he tries to mess up what they're doing, or the way in which he goes against what they're doing, yeah, these things that should cause them to doubt his leadership, they just rationalize and re-justify.
Yes. Which is very funny.
It's hilarious, but also where we're at in society at this point, yes, with stan culture is really just stan ahead culture of the curve as well.
With everything, you know,
yeah,
from celebrities to like whatever politician you've put all your faith in.
Yeah, it's wild, the tribalism these days and how eager people are to rationalize everything through the frame of their tribe.
Yeah.
And Fight Club is kind of doing that in 1999. Just the reliance on technology, the tribalism that occurs, its commentary on consumerism that's going on. Like, I feel like the movie could come out today and it's still incredibly relevant.
It'll always be relevant.
Yeah.
And I think just looking at the movie from a broader point of view and taking everything in mind that you just said, like kind of what the movie is about and what it's calling out, like the sort of satire of the movie, that is infused in every aspect of the movie in such an entertaining way. Like, the movie is funny. It's constantly got this like dark humor. Like, when the people are like, his name was Robert Paulson, like they're just completely missing the point of what the narrator is saying and just like creating some new chant, or when they're going to cut his dick off in the police station. Like, they just don't get it.
His balls.
Well, they might have gone off for the dick too, yeah, if you put up a struggle. But their stupidity is like so over the top that it's satire. Like, it's funny. Yet, mm-hmm, the further and further it goes that direction, like, the more intense and scary it becomes. Mm-hmm. And as you're saying, like, it's really not that different from what you see in real life. So, like, the comedy of it becomes like a little troubling. It's just really cool how the whole tone and nature of this movie, it explores all these topics. Like, this movie could have very well just been a straightforward, maybe not. He's seeing somebody in his head. He's like a schizophrenic, like that is extreme, but you could still see this being a more normal, like thriller or something, or a drama where someone just is in a headspace and needs to get out of it. Fincher, I mean, this to me is, this is the David Fincher blueprint here. Like, the way he decides to take this topic and this kind of character and explore them, the way the movie moves, just the graphics of the movie, the way it like zooms around the city and around Tyler Durden's life, or around the narrator's life. It's just so perfectly done, and so realized in a very unique way. Like, I couldn't help but notice this whole movie, you know, David Fincher, one of the key parts of its aesthetic these days is it's a very pale color palette. Yeah. But in this movie, it's shadowy as fuck. Like, the shadows in this movie are insane. Usually movies are lit to where, like, there are shadows, you know, like in a film noir, there are shadows, but they're done in a more designery, flowery way where they like, kind of accent them. Like, in this movie, like, you only see like an eighth of Tyler Durden's face when he's in the basement. And it's like shroud. Like, that's cool. And it's part of this movie and what it's saying and how it's exploring its characters. It's just such a Fincher movie through and through in that way, that it was so delightful for me to like watch this movie knowing like, oh, it's only his third movie or something. And he's got it. Like, this is it. This is how his movies are going to be from now on.
It's kind of, I mean, I think about Fincher lately, though I haven't seen Mank.
Oh, really?
But when I think of Zodiac or even The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, it seems like post Fight Club, there was almost a settling down of the camera to where not as much as Villeneuve, how we talked about with kind of the freaking minimalism. Static. Yeah, the staticness and minimalism of 2049 and Dune, and even somewhat with Arrival. But definitely more so than Fight Club, to where Zodiac feels very tense and patient.
Right.
And even Curious Case of Benjamin Button has this kind of, I am being above it all and taking a much more, not omniscient perspective, but look how refined I am now.
Yes.
Which is just funny to go back to Fight Club and see that there's so much chaos going on in the movie.
It made me think of The Social Network, actually, because the last time I watched The Social Network, I was like, it wasn't hitting the same. Like, I used to love that movie.
Yeah.
And rewatching Fight Club now, I'm like, I feel like I kind of see what it is. It's sort of what you're talking about, where Social Network, like, it kind of has the same approach. Like, it is brashly comedic. The characters are overblown. They're devilish. There's something like just extra about everything, yet it's moving so much more slowly. Even though like the movie is edited very well, the transitions between, like, it's such the Sorkin thing where like somebody's talking and it leads into this and it leads into that, you know, like it has the David Fincher feel. But it's not like Fight Club. Like, Fight Club, I guess it just feels, the vitality of Fight Club to me is what stuck out this time. Like, there's such intensity and energy to everything, yet at the same time, like, you don't ever feel behind. Like, you always feel in step and with it. There's something about that approach that to me is just so much more appealing than where he eventually went.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I still really love, he's love great. Zodiac. I love Button. I love Social Network, and especially Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I think that's my second favorite.
It's all good stuff,
Fincher. But there is just such an energy and pizzazz to Fight Club. And what you said earlier about like the perfect movie in terms of, not just perfect in the sense of greatness, but perfect in the sense of everything being in service to what it's trying to say and what it's trying to do. It's the most perfect movie to me that I've ever watched in that regard. Mm-hmm. Like every shot, every line of dialogue, all the mise-en-scene choices, it all accentuates and establishes everything that's going on thematically and narratively in such a way that it's just, I'm blown away by every moment in the movie. And that was the thing that jumped out to me this time too, because it's been, I've seen Fight Club definitely over 20 times, but it's been 3 or 4 years since I last watched it. Like, I think I last watched it before COVID. And so this is the longest I've gone without seeing it. And just the vitality of the camera work and how much is going on, not just in the foreground or the focus of each scene, mm-hmm. but in the midground and the background. And the way in which the camera moves, the dynamics of the shot range and shot selections. Like, we've talked a lot on the show about static camera or long takes versus cameras that move or a lot of cuts. And I feel Fight Club's just a perfect example of the middle ground of all of that, to where some shots linger, but every time it cuts, I don't know where the camera's going to go. I mean, I know at this point because I've seen it so much, but in the sense of there's not a rhythm or a pattern that it really falls into, to where it almost feels like every single shot is doing something interesting in its framing, in what it has going on in some part of the mise-en-scene, whether it's the color palette, whether it's the extras or actors or just the design space around the character, or the lighting, as you're saying, with the shadow, the shadows at various parts. I'm forever just interested in where it's going next with the editing.
Right.
And I barely get that from any movie.
Yeah.
It's something that I realized in the years, the many movies I've watched since I last watched this, how much I crave what Fight Club's doing and how few filmmakers actually, I don't know, have the skill to do it or the budget to do it. I mean, it's not like this budget was great, but or the
maybe vision.
It's not in vogue. Yeah, maybe just the vision to be able to accomplish it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but Fincher with this movie had it.
I think a big moment for me was where I had already had a sense that the movie had a meta narrative. I mean, the movie doesn't really hide it, I guess. but the scene where Tyler Durden's giving the speech to the camera and the film reels are kind of shaking around him.
Yeah.
It like something clicked while I was watching it, and I had just watched Scream. And to me, the beauty of Scream is it's so obvious with the meta horror thing, in a way that the more meta it becomes, the more reflective of reality to me it becomes. And to me, this is kind of a beauty of horror, of meta movies in general, that when you place a character in a meta movie, either they're aware of the archetypes or tropes they're supposed to follow, or we're just extra aware of them. So it becomes this dance of them trying to form their own identity and rebel against what is expected of them in this narrative that we're all so familiar with. And to me, Scream just does it better than probably any movie ever, where Sydney's whole journey is to kind of, she's in this dance of figuring out what happened with her mom and who she really was and whether it defines her as well. Like, if she's going to follow in her footsteps, kind of, or she's going to go in a new direction. Like, there's, in the whole time, Billy's pushing her to be a certain way and pushing her to be in this horror movie, and she's battling back against it. It's so cool. Fight Club does that to, like Scream kind of does it in a 101 sort of way, where, like, that's why I like it. Like, it's so easy to grasp, and I love it. Fight Club is like, oh my God. Like, it's not really a complaint I have about Fight Club, but it is, it's such a dense movie. It's kind of, and it's not that it, even that it's difficult to understand, as we've said, like it kind of lays everything out for you. You understand it. But because there's so much going on, it's a little hard. I guess I don't know how to phrase it. It's just a harder movie to understand, I guess. Like, it's just denser. There's more to it in a way. And that scene where the film reels are shaking, like, it kind of, like, it shakes you into realizing that what you're watching really is in somebody's head. Like, it is part of a narrative being crafted for them. And that's the beauty of Fight Club, is like, where Scream, it's using horror movies as the structure, where like Sydney needs to break out of this horror movie. But in Fight Club, it's life. Like, this life you're supposed to live, what's been decided for you. And the narrator is constantly caught within that. Like, he's even called the narrator. Like, this movie is almost about storytelling in that way, and making stories or making movies, and being within the movie, and like being expected to do this or that. So I just think that's really genius for it to like be meta in that way. Like, it's such an interesting way to use meta. Like, it's not meta like Scream, where like, oh, it's a horror movie. It's meta in the way that like we're all kind of living this story. Like, we're all caught up in a story, and like we're supposed to be acting a certain way, you know?
Yeah, it's similar to Truman Show almost.
Sure, yeah.
In the commentary Truman Show is making about this guy's life has become a television show, or is scripted in this way, which makes you start thinking about your own life and the implications, not of like somebody scripting your life, but just in the sense of, are you behaving in a way or falling under the influence of some of these things in society that try to shape us and guide us, which is what Fight Club talks about with consumerism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like we're all the characters in this consumerism movie that are supposed to be doing things a certain way. And he's essentially breaking out of the movie, or also accepting the movie, but also kind of destroying the movie.
Yeah, totally.
It opens up a lot of conversation points. You even have the dialogue between them when you come back to them in the building. And he says, I still haven't thought of anything. And Brad Pitt laughs and goes, flashback humor.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's such a... They clearly know that they're having flashbacks in a movie. But what does that mean for us? How are we supposed to take that? That's such a small part that has... It's an iceberg of it, little moments in the movie, but the implications of them and the ways in which you can take them are huge. But you're already trying to kind of wrap your mind around everything it's saying about consumerism, relationships. Yes.
That's what I meant. It's like Scream's kind of easy in that way, but like Fight Club, they're like 10 things you have to pay attention to.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the movie, as much as the movie is about society and the self, you could also look at it as a very existential or defamiliarized existential struggle of this guy in his 30s settling into a relationship. And totally. It's just a very dramatic and over-the-top way of showing somebody who is immature going through all of these deep... philosophical, existential, revolutionary things that part of dating somebody that you really care about and realizing that you want to commit to them and be in this relationship with them, and having to get over yourself and get over the previous things that had kind of defined you,
mm-hmm.
and redefining yourself because of this relationship. I think as I've gotten older, and watching this movie, you know, in my early 20s versus mid 20s versus early 30s versus now at 36, the importance of Marla's character stands out to me so much.
Yeah.
To where, especially on this watch, she was almost the most interesting thing in the movie to me.
She's a hell of an actress.
Yeah. She's crushing it start to finish. The way in which she conveys the emotional journey that her character goes on while also having such little screen time with which to do it is really cool. The vulnerability she starts to show in different points in time.
Totally.
The way in which she reacts knowing that Tyler is Tyler, but Tyler not knowing.
Yeah, especially when you rewatch the movie and you know what the twist is, like you really do see like her beat by beat reaction to like, God, I really like this guy, but something's wrong with him.
Yeah, and just the little subtle facial reactions that she has to things that he's saying and doing, and the way in which she's trying to be patient with him, try different approaches with him. It was just very fascinating to me, every choice she was making and every moment she was on screen. And just the fact that he's such a maniac when he's just on his own or left to his own devices, but finding this balance as part of trying to be ready for a relationship with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was pretty fascinating to me.
I mean, the ending, again, perfect movie, cathartic at the end. Like, the ending perfectly caps off everything you're saying in this journey he has of Marla. I mean, a big part of the movie is the narrator lacks a sense of humanity. Like, he has no identity. You know, there's no humanity to his life pre-Tyler Durden, where he's just like buying all the IKEA furniture and doing a mindless job and doesn't really think about how to enhance or fulfill his life. And Tyler seemingly presents an option, like a path, but really all Tyler's doing is dehumanizing people as well. Like, he gives these big, broad statements that really, in the end, just group everybody into this box where, you know, you're supposed to be living this kind of life, but you need to do this instead. And all, in the end, all you're doing is just rebelling and creating mayhem, which is like no way to live and doesn't foster, doesn't create like a healthy foundation to build something new. It's all this dance to, again, go back to the middle, where you can see these two extremes and realize like where you can center yourself. And in the center is where he has real relationships. And he starts to realize how much Tyler is dehumanizing both himself and everybody that's part of Project Mayhem as he gets pulled deeper and deeper into it. Like, when Bob dies and everybody's like, he doesn't have a name. We don't have names in Project Mayhem. And he's like, no, this man had a name. He it's the first time we see him like genuinely caring about somebody. And maybe even him in that moment is realizing like, oh God, like I cared about him. Yeah. Like, I'm not like, he starts to see like what Fight Club has done to him and what everything is around him, like that it doesn't stand, like it's no way to live. And so, yeah, Marla, it definitely fits into that. Like, that's the moment he realizes like, I actually care about Marla. Like, I want to be with her. I want to make this work. But before I can, I need to fix this Tyler Durden problem. Yeah, so I just love that about the movie on this viewing. Just, it was the first time I realized how delicately handled the main character was. Because the movie, it gives off the feel of, it's very brash, it's very violent, it's kind of bro-y. you don't think of it as like, oh, it's like a nice character study about somebody fixing their life, but it really is.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah, the fact that, I mean, there have been a lot of comments on the current article, which is just about the ending of Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that Marla wasn't real in the movie.
Oh, God.
And we even got one. I got like the email while we were talking from somebody saying the same thing, that Marla in the books is just a manifestation, which, or in the book, is just a manifestation, another personality.
Uh-huh.
But I think even then, the movie clearly went in a different direction. I don't think there's any evidence in the movie to point to Marla just being another personality.
No.
But even then, it's still like the same thing of like, if he's encapsulating all of this masculine angst about who you're supposed to be, who you think you're supposed to be, who the world's telling you that you should be, and really coming back to just who he is, there is something about needing that balance of the feminine energy, to where if you're all just alpha male all the time and trying to be that, you're like probably crazy or driving yourself crazy. Most of us embody both the yin and the yang aspects, right?
Yes.
The masculine and the feminine. There's the having both. So at the end of the movie, whether she's real or not, having them holding hands and having that counterpoint to the insane masculine crisis that he had been going through is a pretty important part of everything that the movie's saying. But
yeah,
it does make me think about the book. Have you haven't read the book?
No.
I've tried multiple times, and I don't like it very much.
Yeah, that's fair. I feel like I can tell what lines from the book are put in the, like when he's saying I am Jack's like self-consciousness or something, you know, like that feels like such a book line.
Yeah, so many of the one-liners. I think Chuck Palahniuk is really good at the one-liners. That was the thing. I've tried to read a few of his books, and I just, because I write fiction, maybe I am
better
unfairly thinking this about him, but it's just every time I read a line by him, I just imagine him patting himself on the back, being like, oh, that was a cool line.
It's a control S moment, like save, all right, I've done enough work today.
Yeah, like, oh, I just crushed that line. Was it that cool? Was it that cool? It's a lot of these lines that feel like somebody aware that they're trying to impress you with them, rather than necessarily them being like the best line for the story.
Right.
There's just such a like an artifice to his writing to me, which is probably a little unfair. I know so many people like him. I know in Portland he's done a lot for the writing community, so it's not like a shot at Palahniuk.
It's a style, yeah.
Yeah, fit my my reading. But even in the parts that I've tried to read of the book, it's so different and so much more almost like a comic book or absurdist in the things that are happening, that the movie really did contain the book in some ways, or make the book a lot more grounded and realistic. Maybe one day I'll finish it, but
I should have mentioned this earlier. I even thought about this when I was thinking about the meta nature of this film, but you saying that people think Marla might be a fictional character, a figment of his imagination, to me, that's just the success of this movie, that someone could have that reading, because Tyler Durden, he is literally a figment of the narrator's imagination, and thus in a meta narrative where we're thinking about the rules of stories and movies, Tyler Durden represents what any character in a movie ever represents. They are everybody, and you can extend this to your life as well, like people are just extensions of yourself, mirrors of yourself, or you look at somebody and say like, oh, they're, you know, this guy reads a lot of books, like I need to read more books. Or that guy's an asshole, I don't want to act like him. Like everyone is a counter to you in that way. And especially in movies and stories, like that's why certain attributes are focused on. That's why some things are exaggerated about people. Like they're all meant to highlight something about the character we're following that we care about, and it's part of that character's arc. So the narrator here, he sees Tyler Durden, he just learns like, okay, I don't want to live that way. Marla, to me, just everybody in the movie could be that, really. Anybody in any movie could just be a figment of your imagination, in quotes, and that like all movies are about just our internal landscape and this sort of journey we're on. And everybody we encounter is just part of that journey, part of whatever simulation we're in. And so I could see people looking at Marla and thinking, like, she's also just part of that formula.
Yep. Yeah, I absolutely.
Which,
yeah, that
as somebody who loves meta movies, like, to me, that is just so badass. To there's the very idea of Tyler Durden, like, he's the most meta character ever.
Yeah, he is the character. Right?
Yeah, he's not real.
No, he's just a figment. And I mean, in some ways, only really visually there for the movie.
Right.
I don't know,
This movie could have been the exact same story, but Tyler Durden's not there. And you're just watching the narrator character go through the same tics, emotions, same character arc, pushes Marlo away, realizes his humanity at the end, like, blah, 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 and then realizes he wants to be with her. Like, that could just be a normal story.
I mean, it's not too different than Memento, right?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, Memento, he's not, doesn't have this alternate personality, but with his
right
memory issues, he kind of has this other version of him who's
yes.
doing things, but it's a lot more grounded in its approach, where Fight Club's a lot more bombastic in its approach.
Yes.
And Memento is a much more traditional thriller.
Yep. I mean, it's a Nolan movie. He's making it for the masses.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the difference in Nolan, like, just in general.
Yes.
To me, I know the podcast has become like punch on Nolan randomly in episodes, but
we'll do an Inception episode where we just praise him. Okay.
Yeah, that's will happen. But you compare Memento to Fight Club, and I get why some people would prefer Memento to Fight Club, but I just feel like it's so drastically not even close in terms of the craftsmanship on display between both movies. And Memento's still a really well-made,
yeah,
dynamic, interesting movie. It's not trying to say that it's bad in any way, but it's just relative to Fight Club.
Yeah.
It's night and day to me.
I feel like also, too, you look at a movie like Memento and you might think it's smart compared to something like Fight Club, which can give off the image of, like, brutish or, like, blockheaded kind of, or caveman, Neanderthalish, you know? Like, it's just so, like, and I think that's just part of its reputation and, like, all the bros liking it and just taking out lines from the movie. And just the general, like, look of it and feel of it. Like, it's such a dude movie in the most generic sense that I feel like I did that with Fight Club. Like, to me, Fight Club wasn't a smart movie. Like, at most, it could be a fun movie with an interesting twist. But obviously, it's the more you dig into it and the more we're talking about it here, you just realize all it's doing.
Yeah, I think that it's a really not a great comparison. And there's going to be people that are just like, yes, yes, you've said great things. And then what I'm going to say next, people are going to be like, you completely lost me. Now you just sound like a dumb film bro. But I feel like Joker it's similar to Joker in that there's a very superficial way of taking this movie.
Right. A lot of people did that with Joker.
And if you do that, then of course you think this movie, Joker, are superficial. But that there's a craftsmanship to each of those movies and subtextual layers to each of the movies that make them a bit more than what they are. Fight Club, I would argue it's a lot more than what they are. I don't think Joker is even close to Fight Club in terms of quality, but I think they're similar in the fact that you have people that look at them very superficially, judge them very superficially, and then feel superior to them while missing the iceberg components.
Yeah, right.
And it's not like Joker has all that much more going on.
Right.
But there's more than what a lot of people will give it credit for. And that gets exhausting to kind of encounter all the time. Same with Fight Club.
That reminds me of what I was saying about Scream earlier. And, you know, Scream and Fight Club are polar opposites in that way, that both are easy to follow. Like, you know what Fight Club's about, but, like, there's more to follow. Like, there are more threads, I guess, in Fight Club. Where Scream, there are threads, like there are like sub themes and extensions of the meta nature of the movie, but they're not like super complex or anything. Like they're laid out very thin for you. Is that the right phrasing? They're just laid out for you.
Yeah, laid out for you.
Yeah. In the way that like I would think that about Joker. Like, and that's just a stylistic approach to a movie. It doesn't make your movie stupider. It doesn't make it less complex. It's just you've chosen a broader path, kind of like a more open path. It's more, to me, you could argue it's just a more engaging path. Like, you're totally like seeing the machinations of the movie and you just get what it's saying. But still, something like Scream, there's plenty to dig into with that. Like, you can be broad, but be really smart about the things you're saying and have very detailed characters and interesting arcs. Like, there are just plenty of different ways to go about constructing a character and a theme in a movie. And I feel like Joker does kind of fall into that camp where it's not difficult per se. Like, you get what the movie is, but the character's just so interesting, the way they handle him. And the commentary is sort of so broad about society that there's just so many conversations to have within it. And then because of it, the movie becomes more and more interesting the more you think about it and talk about it.
Yeah. To some people.
Yeah, but you're right. Because it's simple. I just feel like people have that attitude about something that's... I mean, I'm a lifelong defender of Showgirls, and I feel like it suffers from that curse that, like, it is what it is, like, so flamboyantly on the surface that people hate it. And it's what makes me love it.
Yeah. I mean, we saw the same thing with other Verhoeven in terms of the initial reaction to RoboCop, the initial reaction to Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
There can be... When there's an obvious layer, and then... some less obvious talking points or more nuanced talking points, a lot of the time, if people didn't like the obvious layer or the movie's getting praised too much,
yeah,
then they latch on to the obvious layer as a point of criticism. Mm-hmm. And only see that.
Yep. What are you going to do?
What are you going
keep
to do?
Keep loving Fight Club and keep loving Showgirls. That's what.
Yeah. You know, there's a... Palahniuk wrote a sequel to Fight Club.
I do. See, isn't Marla in the sequel?
Yeah, yeah.
So wait, she's not imaginary in the book then, right?
I mean, there's something to be said about maybe she was intentional and like she was in the one and then it's retconned a little bit, or maybe she's still a figment in the second one. I just remember reading that it takes place 10 years later, mm-hmm. and they just had a kid, mm-hmm. I think, or... have a young kid, and apparently Tyler's back. And it's just like, okay, what's the point of the first story then? Getting rid of Tyler if he's just going to come back and you have to do the whole thing over.
That's a tough sell, because you could see it working in a sense that, oh, he's a dad now and he's facing a whole new set of challenges and pressures in a way that Tyler Durden's aura can comment on. It's just tough when Tyler Durden is literally a character and has been killed and is just, like, coming back. Like, it's tougher to make that journey interesting when you know he's not real. And now the narrator is just going through a regular journey that any person would go on, you know, in a normal story.
Yeah, it just becomes having a sounding board.
Yeah, but then maybe he makes it work, though. I don't know. I haven't read it.
I never will.
I probably won't either.
Maybe they'll make the movie and they'll find a way to improve it.
Yeah. Venture, get on it.
I don't know. Was there anything else that jumped out to you? Any like favorite scene, least favorite scene?
Why don't you talk about your favorite scene and I'll think about it.
My favorite moment is still early in the beginning when he's talking about insomnia. Because many movies that I had watched up to that point were just fun adventures, right? Or fantastic things that might never happen to me. I had never really watched a movie at that point that was just a thing I was going through. I mean, aside from, you know, Little Big League. No, not even Little Big League. I wasn't owning a Major League Baseball team. But, you know, Sandlot, something like that. Yeah. where you're like a kid playing sports. Most movies were just these big adventurous things. So having Fight Club have this moment where he's talking about insomnia and that whole stretch of him having insomnia and describing insomnia. And there's that moment where he's standing in the office and he said, everything is a copy of a copy of a copy. And it's a shot of the office. You see him standing at the copy machine and he looks up and it's just, I don't know what the lens is that they used, but it widens the scene, but also flattens the depth of field. So everything kind of feels collapsed in on each other. And I remember pointing to the screen like I was Leonardo DiCaprio in the meme from Wolf of Wall Street, where he's just like, oh, that thing. That's exactly what it's like. That sense of distance, but closeness, and the weird way in which the world suddenly seems flat because you're so sleepy that everything has just kind of muffled out and is losing its texture. It's the only shot, which is, we have a lot of attempts in film to capture the visual experience of something. Like if somebody's feeling sick, the camera might, you know, go first person and kind of drift around if somebody's kind of like falling left and right and a little dizzy, that kind of thing. Or if they're passing out and you see the edges start to creep in. We have these times where the camera tries to mimic perception, but usually it's very obvious things like that. It's mimicking the movement. It's mimicking the darkening of the vision. This is the one time I can think where the camera has captured the experience of insomnia. It's something that's that weird and that nuance, just through the depth of field and the framing and what it's showing and the movements of the people. I've never seen anything else like it in all the movies I've ever watched.
Yeah. It's pretty great.
And I love it so much.
I did think of you during that scene.
Yeah.
It's all your talk of insomnia.
Yeah. It's a bitch.
Okay, so I'll say that I think if I had to pick like a favorite part, it's probably just the ending in general.
Yeah.
Just everything that happens at the end. But I will say I was most struck by the scene where Bob dies and the narrator having that moment of like, this was a person, you maniacs. And then like just the comedic misunderstanding of what he's saying. Like, that whole scene is great. But I'll say that the thing I love the most about this movie, and I've already said it, and I was just eating it up, is the shadows. Like, I really love the look of this movie. It just made me think of the rest of David Fincher's movies and how, like, they look similar, but, like, they don't look like this. Like, I don't think any movie looks like this. I just love how in the dark so many of the characters are the whole time. Like, there's no light anywhere ever. I love it.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's just, there's such a vibrancy. And the dark comedy, this movie, this and American Psycho, which I always feel, there's always a part of me that's like, should this be concerning to me? Huh. The American Psycho and Fight Club make me laugh so much as these darkly comic satires of society.
It
but
is
they're
concerning.
Hilarious to me. They just, they make me laugh so much.
Okay. So we're going to rank this bitch or what?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I wonder where Chris has it. I mean, we did Blade Runner recently, and that became your number one, correct?
Yeah, yeah. Blade Runner went to the top of my all-time rankings. It's definitely an all-time movie for me, but Fight Club is my all-time favorite movie.
It's the one.
So, yeah, it's the one. It's, I mean, at this point, probably going to forever be the one. I said to my wife when it ended, you know, if this came out today, I think it would still be my number one.
Yeah.
I would just see it and say, oh, there was also a point that she brought up was about when Marla calls for help. And it was something that I didn't really pick up on before, is the fact that Tyler shows up, right? Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
and takes her out of the place, and she says, you have to keep me up all night. And there's this sense of, oh, maybe he did save her or help her. But the EMTs and medics were right there and would have got there just a few minutes after him.
Right.
And would that have been a tipping point for her to where she finally would have gotten help, would have gotten treatments? Could she have been on a better path after hitting that kind of rock bottom?
Wow, yeah.
And did Tyler actually derail her from finding some kind of help in progress?
Yeah, wow. I didn't think of that either.
Which is kind of fascinating to think about. I do think by the end of the movie, it seems like she's in a better place.
Mm-hmm.
At least the way in which she's interacting with Tyler, her energy, it seems like she's like feeling better. But you also have to wonder what would have happened had people not Tyler Durden been the ones to rescue her and try helping her.
Yeah. Wow. This movie's got layers.
It's got layers, man.
So for the record, these rankings we're doing, they're not every movie we've ever seen. We started ranking movies in 2022. Chris, how long is your list?
My list right now is at 162.
Okay. And this is number one, so it's in the top like 1%.
Yeah, it's...
My list is now up to 464 movies.
Okay.
And I've got Fight Club. I have, like Chris, I have my rankings segmented out into like categories. So this for me is in the third category of everything, and like the third category and above to me are just like, they're special movies. Like they achieve something. Like they're good. There are movies that I think are in the category below. It's like movies that are better than I expect movies to be. Like they transcend a little bit. And then this next category to me is like, I have a connection to it that is special, that is profound. Like I see what it's doing and it's speaking to me and it's commenting on my life. And I consider it special in that sense. So I have it in that category, and I have it at number 77.
Okay, that's it's pretty high for your list. That's top 20%.
Yeah, so way up there. And I, as I said before, every time I've watched it, it's gotten better. So maybe the next time I watch it, it gets into like that super special category.
New number one.
That would be wild.
What's currently? I like this idea of picking a random number on the list and just asking what movies at that number. What's your number 10 right now?
My number 10 right now is Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay.
What's your number 10, Chris?
I need to watch it. My number 10, which is so not representative. That's how
mine
few
is.
Of the... Yeah, mine, I need to rewatch so many of the movies that I like legitimately love. I don't even think this would be in my top 100. but right now, my at number 10 is All Quiet on the Western Front.
A movie I have not seen.
Yeah, the 2022 Netflix one. It's just really, like, really good.
Yeah.
I mean, World War II movies are, I think, hard to make unique.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, I don't know. It's kind of feels generic in ways, but it just builds so impressively and has so many scenes where I'm just like, I don't know how they did that.
Yeah, someday I might watch it. I think modern war movies are like the least interesting to me. Like, not that they're bad, but it's just not in my nature to want to go watch a movie like that.
Yeah, I go back and forth on them. It's a genre that I feel is pretty limited a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of know what's going to happen and why it's happening.
Yeah, right.
But, I mean, Thin Red Line, 1917, I loved. I mean,
Thin Red Line's awesome.
Yeah, All Quiet on the Western Front is great. Like, so, Inglourious Bastards, right,
sure,
is another very unique take. So, there are very unique takes out there, but I'm always really hesitant when I first see one that it's just going to be very vanilla.
I feel like I've only watched the ones that everyone agreed weren't good, and I agreed. Like, I watched Midway, and what was the other one? Oh no, everybody likes Dunkirk. I didn't like Dunkirk, though. But I haven't watched All Quiet on the Western Front in 1917. Like, I'm just choosing the wrong ones.
Oh, man. 1917 on 4K?
I definitely, just because you like it so much, I'm going to take the plunge someday, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although, on paper, I wonder if it's going to annoy me.
I mean, it has a lot of long takes.
Isn't it one long take?
Yeah. But it's so well done.
Yeah, no, I we've talked about, as you said, we've talked about the show several times. I like it when it's done well.
Yeah, I think it's a very unique take on the one take.
All right, yeah, it'll happen.
Okay, what are we doing next?
Well, I feel like last time we talked, we had like two options. We were like, oh, we're going to do one of these two, and we chose Fight Club.
Oh, I think we had talked about Shutter Island.
Yeah.
It also makes me...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe we should do Scream.
The article will be up for Scream. And people like it, and it's October.
Yeah, it seems kind of fitting.
I will do Scream.
Okay, I'll do Scream.
All right. It's a date.
All right, same time, same place?
Yeah, probably.
Beautiful.
But until then, we're gonna wrap things up. Need everyone to shut up. We need it quiet on set for this part. Okay, you ready, Chris?
I'm ready to see what the hell happens with our timing.
All right, lights,
camera.
See ya.
See ya. God.
Yeah, no, a little off.
One time.